Please make sure you go over to YouTube, subscribe, or you can always find us on any of the podcast platforms, and that's Fostering Change.
I just wanted to give you a little bit of a nudge, just a little nudge. See, we still have time to vote for the 100X. Every time you go on and you actually vote, do a survey. It's not really voting. You're surveying, saying, hey, I use Todd products or I use this. But guess what? Every time you do it, they actually send us money. We're almost close to the point where we can get $10,000. Can you believe that? You can vote every day, 7 times a day. I'm not kidding you. It normally takes about 30 seconds to get this done. And what a big impact that makes. That 30 seconds. Just think about it. One child every 2 minutes. We're going to be able to help so many kids by you just going in to 100X. You can go to our website. You can actually find the link. You can register. Just do it while you're sitting there, maybe before you're on Facebook or Instagram, or, you know, some of you enjoying some of the beautiful weather that we do not have here. But hey, do me a big favor. Help us out. Thanks a lot. Take care, everybody.
Well, you know what? It's so hard to believe. We are already in the middle of March. You know, what an amazing year it's been so far. You know, I absolutely am loving this every other Tuesday podcast. You know, for the last 5 seasons, we've done it every week. And I have met some amazing people in the last 5 seasons. As you can see, I've won some amazing awards as well. But what I really am enjoying this every other week is it's allowing me to really take time out, which I think is something that each and every one of us need to do. You know, my next guest, I actually don't know much about him. I've read up a little bit, and you guys know how I am as somebody who hosts a podcast. I want to know as little as possible because I want to learn it when you all learn it. But the thing that I love about what I've read about my next guest is that just like me, you know, he was in the system. Just like me, he joined the military. And I can't wait to hear his story. So without any further ado, Gerald Hawkins, welcome to Fostering Change.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob. It's great to be here today.
So Gerald, tell me, I want to dive right in. So, you know, first of all, you know, why have you decided you want to tell your story?
Why have I decided I wanted to tell my story? Well, I feel as though many people in the world can benefit from my story, similar to how they benefited from learning about your story. There was a time where I was very embarrassed about my story, and I carried that embarrassment with me for north of 2.5 decades until I met my wife. And I told her my story, and she said, hey, that's nothing to be embarrassed about. Actually, it's a good thing. You should probably tell more people about it because you'll quickly realize that a lot of people can gain some positives from some of the things that you have been through in your past. So from that point forward, I was no longer embarrassed, and I was very open about, and honest, I should say, about where I come from, how I came to be what I am today, and the struggle that allowed me to harden the person that I wanted to be as far as what I can endure, what I can overcome, and what I can achieve.
Yeah, I absolutely love that because very similar to what you just said, I was very, very embarrassed about where I came from. The fact that society put the F word in front of my name as a young boy and that, you know, I was put in a box as so many other kids are put in that box. And it actually wasn't until I met my husband and I told him my story, you know, and he probably had never even said the word foster care. You know, grew up in the Midwest, parents married 54 years, you know, and he was the one who said to me, you've got to share your story. But it then took for me to have my children, you know, 15 years ago when my first two children arrived out of foster care, I had realized at that moment that if I'm embarrassed of my past, I'm going to end up raising my children to be embarrassed of their past. And I did want that. So tell me, how did you end up in foster care?
Well, I was in foster care basically from the moment I was born. My biological mother had myself and my older brother. I have an older brother. His name is Justin. She had me in her care for about 1 month. And then one day she was out at a shopping mall. Apparently, the story goes, right, that she was arrested for shoplifting. And she tried to convey to the police officers that, hey, I have a 1-month-old and a 17-month-old in my studio apartment in Highland Park, Michigan. They're home alone. Someone needs to go and go check on them to make sure that they are okay. And none of the police officers believe that this woman could have children. They just were in denial, I guess. I'm not quite sure what the situation was. But eventually, this was 2 days later, mind you, the police officers from Highland Park decided to send a deputy over to the studio apartment that my mother claimed. And lo and behold, my brother and I were there in that studio apartment. It was the winter. It was January, I believe. Yeah, it was January because I was born December. And as you know, Michigan is frigid, absolutely frigid in January. And we didn't have heat. But what we did have, what we did have was an oven. And that oven door was open. And that's how we were, that's how we got heat in the home. And it was still open 2 days later when the police officer showed up. And there I was with my older brother, lying on a mattress on the floor. And from that point forward, we were taken from her custody. We were placed in foster care. And we were bounced around from home to home to home. And that's kind of how I, you know.
Okay, wow. You know, to think of a 1-month-old, you know, no bottle, no diaper changing, for 2 days to be lying there. And for the fact that the police didn't immediately go and look and see if, you know, what, you know, first of all, why was your mom at the store? I mean, was she there because she needed to get formula for you? Was she there because she was trying to get food for you? Was your mother, did she have addiction problems? Did she have mental illness problems? I take me back to what you've learned. And mind the way, you're 1 month old, so you're learning this secondhand from people, you know. Right. And by the way, you know, Gerald, I just did the DNA ancestry thing with one of my sisters, and I'm actually the youngest of 10. Well, finding out that there's a lot more than 10, you know, where my mother had actually sold my brother and my sister for the amount of rent so she could pay rent. So I know dysfunction. So, but I want to know is your mom still alive, first of all?
She is. She's still alive. She actually lives in Florida.
Explain to you why she walked out of that apartment and left an 17-month-old and a 1-month-old with an open stove and went to the
So I did not talk to her from that point. Obviously I couldn't speak at 1 month, but anyhow, she came back into my life when I was in foster care. I had to be 3 or 4 years old. Obviously we're not having those types of discussions at that age. But there was a lapse in time from the age I turned 4 until I was 25, where I had no communication with her at all, right? That was that embarrassment moment that I spoke about at the onset. But when we reconnected, we really didn't dive too deep into what actually transpired that particular day, but it had always been on the back of my mind. And I always wondered, what were you doing? Why did you leave? What were you trying to procure from this place where you didn't have money to do so? So you decided to shoplift. And apparently she was at a mall. Why she was at a mall, I don't know. I don't have that background, but I can tell you that she was at that time, it's hard for me to say, but at that time she was dabbling in an adult dancer. Let's call it that.
There's a lot of humans who are exotic dancers. They put roofs over their kids' heads. You know, I'm a true believer that, you know, it's not a place that I frequent, but you know, at the same time, you know, we have lived and put ourselves in a society that it is very hard to make a living wage. And so, so she's, you know, an exotic dancer. She's trying to take care of her children.
And there was some alcohol addiction as well. Some drug addiction as well. Same with my biological father, heavy drug addiction. So she was trying to, I guess, get goods to sell them ultimately so that she can take care of us back at the home. I'm not quite sure. And it's hard for me to talk about. Usually I flow, I don't really stammer. But I do because this is a very, very tough subject for me to open up. But you know, that was the situation that was explained to me. I've seen all my foster care records, I've read the file, and it's like a Bible. So there's a lot of detail there. But yeah, she just wasn't in the position that she wanted to be at that particular point in time while having two young sons in her life. So
were there any other relatives? Did the system bother to find if there was a grandparent, if there was an aunt, if there was an uncle, if there was a cousin? Did anybody?
There were other relatives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did anybody bother to investigate whether or not that they were suitable enough to raise you two boys?
Not to my knowledge. No, not to my knowledge. But I did have a foster care family that took really, really good care of me and my brother. Actually, I stayed with them for the longest amount of time. But back in 1988, this is when this was, the system did not want, two African-American boys to stay with a Caucasian family because the family was a Caucasian family. And it's in the file, and I'm surprised that they were so verbose in the file to stipulate that, but that was the situation. So they wanted to put us with an African-American family. And they did find an African-American family, but the love that I received from that foster care home was my first real experience of being loved. And I don't remember it verbosely, but I do remember the feeling, the warmth that was within that home. And that foster care family tried to permanently adopt my brother and I, but as indicated, the system just simply at that time in 1988 would not allow that no matter what. And she fought and she fought and she fought, but they just rejected. And we ended up in a different home, which became my permanent home. My brother, on the other hand, was only in that permanent home for 6 months. And then my adoptive mother decided that she did not want to keep him. And we were separated at the age of, I was 5, he was 6. And we didn't reconnect again until I was 24 years old.
Let me tell you, what a fail. What a fail.
Yeah, big fail.
The fact is I have 5 kids, and 4 of my children are children of color. I am a same-sex marriage. And I will tell you, the fight that my husband and I had to do 15 years ago, because it was unheard of two white men to raise 4 black children. And like your foster parents, we did the same thing. We fought and we fought and we fought. And we were fortunate enough that, you know, we had a judge that truly believed that we were the right placement for our children. But it's so sad, you know, first of all, to hear that as a baby, you know, that, you know, your mother's not there. So, I mean, her rights should have been severed within the, you know, by, let's say 24 months, but for you to be gone from home to home and then finally get adopted, but to be split up from your sibling, there should never have been adoption. You know, it's the reason why I have 5 kids is because I have 2 sets of siblings because we refused for them to be separated. You know,
right.
I have to say, you know, where do you get your grit from? Your grit of forgiveness, of not having the anger that I see so many people who've aged out of the system. And by the way, your story is pretty, pretty rough. Where do you get that grit from?
I will tell you in a moment, but I want to go back to something you just said, the fight that you had to go through with your husband. I read up on you and I saw, you know, I noticed that your adoptive children were children of color. And the first thing that jumped out at me was, how was he able to do that? Because in 1988, that was impossible, right? And I kept thinking about that and thinking about it. And I wanted to ask you that question here today, because obviously with my situation is very, very comparable to what you went through, right? But it's just, mine was a little different. Did we lose power? Am I still on?
You're still on.
Okay, all right, sorry.
Let me tell you something, 15 years ago, literally when my husband and I put in an application to be foster parents, the woman who was in charge of placing children did not think that, and we lived in the District of Columbia, the nation's capital, she did not believe that white men should have kids. So she took our file and she stuck it at the bottom of the stack and she refused to ever place a child with us. And that happened August, September, October, November, December, and I'm calling every single week saying, wait a minute, why haven't we had a placement yet? And it wasn't until December where she retired and a new social worker came in and said, hold on for a second, you know, right. And she comes back, she said, Mr. Shear, I don't know how to explain this, but your file was, you know, at the very bottom of the stack, and you've been licensed since July of last year. And within a matter of 2 weeks, our first two children arrived.
There
and
you go.
3 months later, our other two children arrived. But then what happened was 2 years go by, and I finally said, enough is enough. I said, you've got these four kids who are sitting in a foster care system. You've got reunification, adoption, adoption, reunification, adoption. Mom does a little bit, dad does a little bit, and nobody's really doing anything. And then it got to a point where over a year went by and none of the biological parents came to visit. And that's when I looked at my husband and I said, the thing that I never want to see happen is that our children get older in the system and they look back and said, why didn't my dads fight for us? And so I actually asked the social worker to file an adoption petition for us, and she refused. They said, we don't believe that these kids should be adopted by you two. So my husband and I, fortunately enough, we were at a financial situation, we were able to do it. We hired our own attorney and we fought the system, and we brought in bonding study experts. We had to bring in experts to state that because we were gay would not turn our boys gay. We had to bring in an expert stating that because our children were children of color and that we were white, we were not going to change to our children as white. So it was a very expensive, long fight. But
yeah, sounds like it.
We won. At the end of the day, we won. It was meant to be. Yeah. When the District of Columbia didn't want to see it happen, when the social workers didn't want to see it happen, the two people that really stood next to us were our children's attorneys that the DC had appointed. And they were like, these kids are in a loving home. So it just, you know, I, again, thank you for asking what my part was, but I really want to know again, where did you grit?
Yeah. So two things. I'll start with the first. When I was adopted, my adoptive mother, she gave us great love at the onset, and I would say that had a shelf life. Once we no longer were cute, that changed, and it changed quickly. So I was adopted. I was just about five, and when that shelf life expired, I was about eight. And when I turned eight, my adoptive mother basically gave me up to her sister, my Aunt Marianne. And my Aunt Marianne is one of the toughest women I've ever met and ever have come in encounter with in my entire existence on this earth. But the other side of her is she welcomed and loved everyone. Everyone in my family would drop their kids off at my Aunt Marianne's house because she didn't know how to say no. She would literally give the shirt off of her back to a homeless person without even thinking about it. And she basically raised me from 8 until 16. And that's what I knew. And that's what I have come accustomed to. So she had that level of grit, which I picked up on, but she also had a soft side. And she showed me that love is blind, and whatever your heart, you know, pulls you to do is basically what you end up doing. So she taught me that, not directly. This was indirectly me watching her over the years. And then the second side of that coin is, you mentioned this at the onset, my military service. So at the age of 17, and I'm telling you, I had just turned 17 at this time, my adoptive mother said, okay, well, we need to get Gerald out of my home. The best thing we can do is either go to Job Corps, which she made me do as well, in Cleveland, Ohio. It was supposed to be a two-year program. I completed the entire program in 2 months. Within those 2 months, I received a vocational trade and clerical work because that was the only thing computer related. And I received my GED at the age of 16, which foiled her plans because she thought I was going to be gone until 18 and then I would be a legal adult. So at that point, I was forced to graduate from the program, return back to Michigan. And my mother, adoptive mother at that time, was thinking, what can I do? What can I do? I got to get him out of here. I don't want him, basically. So the military came to be. And I joined the military. I scored very, very high on the ASVAB, the entrance exam to get into the military. And at that time, I was 6'4", 6'5", honor guard. became an opportunity for me. So I was stationed in Fort Myer, Virginia, very, very close to Washington, D.C., as you know. So I was in the Honor Guard for 3 years, presidential escort to George W. Bush. I had my presidential security clearance. I've worked so many different missions at the White House, at the Pentagon, at the Capitol. And that's really the second coin or the second side of where I got my grit from, because that's also where I was able to develop the appreciation for family and camaraderie and brotherhood. I didn't have that growing up in my natural home, right? But in the military, you have no choice. These guys to your left and to your right, they're your family, right? And you will do anything for them. So that gave me that level of grit, that level of tenacity, that level of never, ever, ever giving up, no matter what. And that has basically set me up for success as I am a 40-year-old man now. I've achieved great success with my family. I have two beautiful daughters, Michaela and Zoe, and an amazing wife. I have a great career, and I have no regrets.
Wow. I love that. I absolutely love that. Let me tell you something, Gerald, that is an amazing story. And as you said in the very beginning, your wife said you should tell your story because you never know who you're going to help. And she's exactly right. And I tell that to people. For those of us who are brothers and sisters of the foster care system, it is our obligation to tell our stories of success. It's our obligation to tell our stories of the woes we went through to make sure that the kids that we are telling, who are in the system, can who truly believe that there is hope out there. Because you know as well as I do, when you're in that system, when you're fighting out of that well, you find no hope. And so by hearing people finally starting to talk about it, and by the way, I went in the system in 1979, I aged out in 1984. There was nobody talking about foster care, and there was nobody giving a damn about kids in foster care. And so now I look back, you know, my kids have been, you know, with us, you know, 15 years. We actually just adopted our fifth child, and we adopted him at the age of 18, because I truly do believe that children, if we invest in them, will make our future brighter. And Gerald, I just tell you what, you just made this episode brighter. Listen up, everybody. I say it all the time. Each and every one of us have a story. We have a story, and we never know how that story will impact someone. And I will tell you, as I listened to Gerald's story, there were several things that came to mind for me. You know, the time that I was in the military, and about how he is so right that it gave us a sense of brotherhood, a sense of family, something that we thrive and want so much. But what I also took away from this today, and I hope each and every one of you took away from this, is the fact is that no matter where you come from, about no matter who you are, no matter what your color is, no matter what your sexual preference is, no matter what, we all deserve to be loved, just like his aunt loved him. You know what, Gerald, I want to say thank you so much for being on Fostering Change. And everybody, as I say it all the time, you know what, this is the reason I do this. You know, any questions, any comments, please, you can always drop us a line at info@comfortcases.org. And until next time, I hope you continue to do what I say often, be a good human. Gerald, take care. And I wish you and your family all the best. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you. Thanks for having me.